This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free. And catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Going to start today off with our thoughts and prayers and hopes and whatever policy we're going to need, whatever help for the folks in Hawaii. I don't know if you've seen the videos coming out of Maui and what they call the Big Island. It looks like the whole place is on fire. It was all like a perfect storm of high winds and fire and all just horrible. Last report I saw, at least six people have died in the wildfires that have raged on Maui. And the videos and some of the stories that I've heard of, people are just jumping into the water, hoping to be rescued by the Coast Guard or by others because it's literally all on fire. And I know, climate change isn't real. That's what my conservative friends keep telling me, or at least the man-made part of it now isn't. Now, as I understand, all of the 911 communications is down. And this is all, I guess, the result of the high winds from Hurricane Dora and the fires that they'd had. Again, I'm looking at these videos and just total devastation. And you go, you know, at some point, if that doesn't move you to action, I don't know what will. If seeing, you know, this just incredible devastation doesn't move you to go, hey, we need to do something about this. Not quite sure what will. And you know, I look at what this administration has been moving on to address climate change, and it's a step in the right direction. I look at all of the effort to stop that small step. And there are days when I'm hopeless, and I look at there and I feel hopeless. I feel helpless to help those people in that position, but I feel hopeless in that, and that maybe we can't solve big problems anymore because we can't solve small ones. And I'm going to point to the story that I've been kind of fixated on today. There was a story out of Michigan. A 17-year-old kid was working for a meat processing plant, U.S. Guys Processing. And the story says that, you know, he lost his hand in a grinder. Now, you know, 17-year-olds, I don't know, should be, I don't know, around grinders. But what caught my attention wasn't the fact that this 17-year-old kid was working in a place that, you know, was dangerous for him. And now is going to lose a hand. Or has lost a hand. My thought is the response to it. The response to it is, well, you know, it was a tragedy, you know. And the judge who fined the person who owns the processing plant or the company, fine, they got a fine of, and this is one of those things that I'm stuck with. $1,143. That's the fine. And you go, you know, I've said before, if I ever wanted to kill someone, I would just hire them and put them in a dangerous position and well, you know, do whatever I needed to do because, you know, human life is cheap in the work environment. Now, what I find interesting, I spent a little time looking at social media comments. And now understand, this situation is unique. Understand, this is a unique situation. This is a minor, a 17-year-old, who, as the judge said, in 2 months, it wouldn't have mattered because then he would have been 18. So it wasn't really a big deal. Still a minor. But that was the reason for this, you know, for the lack of any real penalty. A little slap on the wrist. Fortunately, that guy still has a wrist. And you know, nothing further. And I spent time in the comments, and I tell you not to, because there's nothing positive in the comments. But what was amazing to me is the number of people who were commenting, well, you know, he's going to sue that employer, and you know he's going to get millions of dollars. It's one of these moments where, as Americans, we're so, steal a Ronald Reagan line, there's so much that we know that isn't so. This is one of those things. This kid was employed, so he's going to be covered under workers' comp. Now, someone said the caveat here potentially is that, you know, he was a minor. There was a fine, so maybe possibly going to get something down the road more than workers' comp. I doubt it, to be honest. Because, again, the mentality is, well, he was only a couple of months away. He's a high school dropout. And, oh, by the way, we told him not to do it. So I'm reading through all these comments, and the comments are all in the same kind of line. Well, he's going to sue, and he'll get pain and suffering, and he'll get all this stuff. And as anyone knows, workers' comp, you don't get pain and suffering. I actually looked up Michigan's workers' compensation law, which was passed, you know, or last amended, I guess. Or no, it was actually passed in 1969. The Workers' Disability Compensation Act of 1969, Act 317, by the way. And what it says is, you know, you're going to get 80% of your pay. And if you lose a hand, 215 weeks. That's what you're going to get. A little over 4 years. Because what happens in a lot of states, these workers' compensation laws, they lay all this stuff out meticulously. It's like an insurance policy, because it is. And this idea that you're going to be able to then sue doesn't happen. Because the great compromise that was made when they allowed workers' compensation to be passed, and employers weren't upset by it, because now they're no longer really liable. It's just an insurance thing. You get hurt, somebody will pay. Some of my premiums may go up a little bit, but it's not my problem. And Republicans throughout the years have been doing their foolhardy best to minimize the benefits and the accountability for corporate America. So, like in my state of Pennsylvania, 1996, they did a major overhaul of workers' compensation, where if you get hurt in this state, pretty much the maximum you're going to get is, I think it's 85% of your pay for 500 weeks. And that's it. After that, you're SOL, you're on your own. Good luck, buddy. Find another gig or go on disability, which is all government's always the backstop for corporate bad ideas. And I spent time reading these comments just amazed that people think this way. And I shouldn't be, because most working people don't, fortunately, don't have to deal with these systems until something really bad happens. And we as Americans don't think we talk enough about this kind of stuff. Whereas me as a union guy, this stuff is front and center. This stuff is important. Policy is important. And which is why I constantly say Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. Look at how they go after and try and gut workers' comp. Look at how they go after unemployment and try and gut that. Look at the fact that they're against raising the minimum wage. Go and look at the policies that they stand for, or obviously don't. And this is one of those things that caught me. And I started my mind was just flowing around this idea, which is why, you know, I go, this is why you see so many third-party logistics companies and so many temp agencies popping up. Because this is a good way to shield the main corporation from, well, any of these pesky things. Because you can start up a temp agency, hire a bunch of people to come in, and then, you know, the main company doesn't have to employ them. The temp agency does. So if they get hurt on the employer's property, it's the temp agency's fault. And when the premiums get too high, they just close up the temp agency and move right along to the next one. Who gets screwed in all this? The workers. And this, again, is one of these moments where my mind just, you know, kept going back to, how is it that there's so much that we know that isn't so? You think of that Great Compromise. I think the first workers' comp law was in, I believe, Wisconsin, 1912. Pennsylvania passed its workers' comp law in 1915. And still refers to the employer-employee relationship as master and servant, which tells you where you working people would fare in this. But when that compromise happened, and I'm no lawyer, but this is what happened, workers gave up their ability to sue in court. They gave up their ability to hold liable the corporations. In return for giving up their constitutional right to sue, they were given medical care and some wage benefits. And that seemed like a good compromise at the time. Because what was happening back then, before workers' comp, and you had the ability to sue, because this is how this suit would work out in a place that didn't have this compromise. This kid, this 17-year-old, would go to sue, and the employer would come forth and say, look, he was a high school dropout. Yeah, we were trying to help the kid out. We brought him in to sweep up and do some stuff. We told him repeatedly, don't put your hand inside the grinder. Told you not to do it. They would say, it's his fault. He deserved what he got. And a jury back then would say, okay. Now, if you paid the jury a little bit, I'm sure that helped too. And that, I'm sure, happened quite often. But the system, again, rigged against the average everyday working person. This reminds me of that exact scenario. And I'm looking at this going, this poor kid. But everyone believes he's going to be taken care of. And that's kind of the world that we're kind of in this moment. And when we come back, I gotta talk about this video. Because it's amazing. I just talked about this last night. My generation and kids, this video caught my attention, and I think it will catch yours as well. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday on the program, we talked about just this. What happened to the American dream? You know, what happened to work hard, play by the rules, get ahead? You know, when I grew up, you know, I struggled, but because I was able to get a good union job and was willing to work 70 hours a week and do all of those things, I did okay. And a lot of parents around my age, a lot of people that I've talked to and a lot of stories I've seen have said, you know, it's not the same as it was when I was a kid. It's not the same environment. So today I see this video of this Jessica McCabe, who went on Twitter and, well, she had this to say.
I am so tired of feeling helpless as a parent. Yes, my kids are grown adults. My oldest is 28, my youngest is 25. And I thought by teaching them what I learned, which is you work hard, you get a good job, you're going to get the things in life that you need, right? Worked for me. Why wouldn't it work for them? Because it doesn't. Because the world has changed, all right? And now I feel like I see them struggling. And before my generation comes at me, yes, I understand struggling is a part of life. We all struggled. But there's a difference between struggling and drowning, all right? So we struggled and it was tough. But you know what? We made it. We knew there was a light at the end of the tunnel with our struggle. It seems like kids today, no matter how much they struggle, they just get further and further down the water into the drowning point, all right? When I was their age, I was making less than $10 an hour, and I could afford to live on my own. Now you have to be making six-figure salary to get a decent, tiny little place to live. So what the f*** is going on, and how do we help them as parents? I told my son, all you have to do is work hard, go to college, or join the military like I did. He went to college, got his degree, got a full-time job. He moved back in with me right when he graduated from college because he said, hey, Mom, as soon as I get a job, which was within 2 weeks of him getting out of college, maybe take me 2 months and I'll save up enough money for me to move out. Okay, cool. It's been 10 months. He has saved almost every dime and still can't afford to live. Why are one-bedroom studio apartments almost $2,000 a month? Why? Like, I just don't get it. So I don't even think that there's even classes anymore. There used to be upper class, middle class, lower class. It's literally turning into the ultra wealthy and then everybody else is just poor.
No, this is one of these things where, you know, you've got this woman from Alabama who is looking at her children and going, you know, they're struggling and their struggle is not getting any easier. And I talked about this yesterday, you know, this idea that if you worked hard, you played by the rules, you got ahead, you knew you took the crappy job, you'd be able to move up, you'd be able to do better, all of this stuff. And as I was listening to her, because when we did our Working Class Heroes tour last year, we went into virtually every community and heard this over and over again. I've been talking about this for a couple of years now. I'd like to know what bubble this woman lives in. I'd love to know what bubble she's been surrounded by all these years, because none of this is new. And what's interesting to me is, and I'm going to go on a limb here and go, I'm betting she voted for Republicans all these years who it's their policies. Now, here's the reality. The party that's able to address her concerns is the party that's going to gain her loyalty. And as I've said, the fact of the matter is I guarantee it. She votes for Republicans. And they are the root of all of these problems. Bad policy brought us here. conservative supply-side voodoo Reaganomics brought us here. Neoliberalism brought us here. And the idea that we don't need unions anymore, the idea that we don't need collective bargaining or solidarity or any, we don't need that. Our corporate masters will somehow take care of us. Well, it's breaking down. When you look at there was a study done a couple of years ago by the Economic Policy Institute that said that CEO pay from 1978 until, I guess it was 18 or 19 when it came out, had risen by 940%. But worker pay, just 12%. And again, we've talked about, you know, from the end of World War II to the middle 70s, how, you know, worker pay and productivity walked hand in hand. As productivity went up, wages went up. A meritocracy. But you had unions there to demand, which is why, as I talked about yesterday, Sean Fain, the UAW president, saying, look, we want 40% raises for our employees over the next 4 years. And where did he pull that number out? Well, he pulled it out of the CEOs and the executives at the automakers. That's what they got, a 40% increase over the last 4 years. He didn't just make it up. He said, look, if it's good enough for you, it should be good enough for us. And I look at that 940% number and go, you know, if it's good enough for corporate America, if it's good enough for the executives in the suits in the boardroom, it's good enough for the people who sweep the floors and do the work and sadly potentially lose a hand while doing it. It's infuriating to me that we're in this space. But I look at her and I say, here's the thing. If you can reach her, if you can share your policies, and you can make her see that you're making lives better, you're going to gain her loyalty and millions of other people. Because maybe now, for the first time, they're finally waking up to the reality that it's not all roses. That dream that they were sold is turned into more of a nightmare. Because we've got a tax code that's rigged, we've got a labor law that's rigged, we've got a system that's completely rigged for the wealthy in this country. You know, CEO pay, we talked about this the other day, 270-1 in 2020, or 2022. In 1965, it was 15-1. You know what else we had in 1965? 35% union density. Let's go to the phones. Alice on one. Alice, how are you?
Totally insane. So what I wanted to say was, with regards to a couple of things. Number one, you got the kid working in there, should never have been in there. Now he's going to lose a hand. And guess what? Who is going to have to handle taking care of things? His family.
Yeah.
They're going to have to pay, no doubt, for his medical.
No, he'll get medical through workers' comp. They'll cover that. But he'll get nothing.
Right.
215
well,
weeks of pay, and he's screwed for the rest of it.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying, where I'm going with this. There's just a basic amount, and then, you know, so they're going to end up having to have a GoFundMe or something. The second thing is, like the woman that was, you know, I don't know, giving her opinion, I guess is what I want to say. Yeah, once upon a time, there was the American dream. But like you said, the system's rigged. But the system is rigged overall. It's not just rigged for the wealthy. It's rigged so nobody can rise any higher anymore. That's, you know, unless you come up with something new and improved and out of this world and make a gazillion dollars on it, selling it for some reason.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people, and I'm going to go with Republicans in particular because I know a number of Republicans, and they all have this mindset. They seem to believe that they're going to end up being wealthy, and that's one of the reasons why, you know, well, we shouldn't have to raise the taxes on the wealthy because well, I'm going to be wealthy.
I'm going to be there someday.
I don't want to pay all that money.
No, I love that Steinbeck's embarrassed millionaire. Yeah, I'm there. I hear it. I know people like that, Alice. Appreciate the
yeah,
thoughts.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, you get what you vote for. And if you're buying into this alternate reality, this conspiracy nonsense that, you know, everybody's lazy and nobody wants to get ahead. And that's why I'm going to vote Republican, because guns, God, and Jesus, you know. Well, then don't complain when it comes back and bites you, because eventually it gets us all. Have a good evening.
Thanks, Alice. Appreciate it. No, I mean, the reality is I feel her. I feel her pain. I do. And what I'm saying is she can be reached, and millions of voters like her can be reached. You just have to get that policy out there. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday we talked about Vice President Kamala Harris in Philadelphia to announce the policy change of, you know, restoring the power of prevailing wage. And as you know, I've been a big supporter of prevailing wage and project labor agreements for a very long time. But the vice president was at the Finishing Trades Institute in Philadelphia, where she gave her remarks. And look, it's about making jobs better. It's about making those jobs pay better. It's about addressing, you know, that woman we talked about a minute ago, making sure that her kids have the ability to move out of the house and start their own lives. And here to share some thoughts on the event in Philadelphia, I've asked Jim Williams Jr. to come talk with us. Jim is the general president of the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, IUPAT.org, the website. Jim, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick. It's always a pleasure.
So the vice president was in Philly. I just kind of screwed up your union's name.
Yeah, you got it right when you said IUPAT.org. I jokingly say that's okay if that's the only thing she screws up. I think we're going to be all right.
And that's really the message that came out of that. I mean, she hit it out of the park, I thought, talking about how we're going to raise wages, ensure that the work that's being done with our tax dollars is being used to generate economic activity in communities. It doesn't sound like a downside here to me.
No, this truly is like, you know, you're hearing the administration try to label Bidenomics as the new economic, you know, positioning of the government. And, you know, this is like one of those very, very detailed, wonky kind of things that truly speak to what that means about building the economy from the middle class out versus, you know, from the Reaganomics era of trickle-down economics. And this is like one of those examples that is right on display of restoring, you know, Davis-Bacon prevailing wage back to what the original intent of the law was when it was passed as a New Deal era piece of legislation to help support public works projects to get us out of the depression.
Right.
You know, this is this Bidenomics is a restoration and a turning around of all of those years of Reagan trickle-down economics. And this is one of those examples.
No, I keep saying it. This administration is ending the era of supply-side voodoo Reaganomics and neoliberalism. They're just not touting it and saying it the right way and not getting it out there. But this prevailing wage, Davis-Bacon, this is a part of this. But understand, the vast majority of people have no idea what we're talking about when we talk about prevailing wage laws. So if you could, you know, because this is your world, explain to folks, you know, what the original intent of the prevailing wage law was and how it worked through the 50s, 60s, and really, you know, the 83 seems to be the year they're pointing to when things started to go south. So if you could give me a little bit of that history, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. And I'll try to do so in a very quick manner to lay out exactly where the inflection points were. But if you remember in the Depression, we had the most public works projects ever. The government was wanting to put people back to work in good paying jobs, very similar to where we stand today. And in order to do so, to make sure and ensure that they were good paying jobs, they came up with prevailing wage laws through the Davis-Bacon Act, that when a survey would be done, the survey They would survey the construction workers in a geographical area, and it's usually done by counties in the United States. And if a wage prevailed at over 50%, that would be what the federal government would pay the contractors that did the work on the projects. Well, and it lasted that way all the way until 1983. And it was, you know, it was honestly one of the attacks that the ABC and other, you know, anti-union forces lined up against in the 1970s to try to weaken union strength. And they were successful under Reaganomics. And under the change in the provisions in 1983, they changed the formula to say that if you didn't prevail over 50%, well, sorry, let me make a correction. In the 1930s, the number was 30%. In 1983, they jumped it up to 50%. And on top of it said, we'll just take an average wage if nobody has over 50%. So that average wage wouldn't take into effect collective bargaining increases. You've seen them last sometimes for 15 years without increases, with no surveys being done. The change that the administration announced yesterday is to go back to the 30% and modernize and update the survey system and put more enforcement against employers that violate not paying the prevailing wage laws. And look, the interesting part about this is the ABC and other anti-union groups came out against it day one and said this is a handout to big labor. The truth is, any worker, regardless of whether they're union or non-union, are going to see their wages go up when these surveys get released and the wages are increased. It doesn't matter if you're union or non-union. If you're working in the construction industry on federally funded projects, you're going to see your wages go up.
Yeah,
well, so it shows you what they really think of workers.
Well, in places where, as you pointed out a second ago, employers aren't cheating them. And I've known a lot of non-union construction workers who their contractors have cheated them on the prevailing wage rates, where they're doing jobs that should be paid at a higher rate and they're being classified as something different. So to hear that there's going to be more enforcement, I think is really good to hear, because, you know, we need that. But more importantly, we need the money in the communities, because what we know and what research has shown us, and you know this better than anyone, when that construction worker, when that painter is making a good wage, they're spending that money on Main Street. They're spending that money in their community, and it's reverberating through. So it's a win-win all across the board.
Of course it is. And when you look at the record amount of government spending that's being pumped into the construction industry tied to Davis-Bacon and prevailing wages, this is truly going to be a monumental period, the next 10 years of having workers making family sustaining wages and building communities out, because prevailing wages and Davis-Bacon were extended into things that they've never been extended before under the passage of the CHIPS and Science Act. Anybody that gets federal spending through the CHIPS and Science Act is going to have to pay Davis-Bacon wages on the construction of their projects. Same thing with the IRA. It's not just the infrastructure bills that were passed. The interesting part about modernizing the Davis-Bacon system and going back to the old formula is that it applies to more work now than ever before.
No, that's a good thing. Now, I gotta ask you this, because I got an email from a listener in Chicago who said, it's all fine, well, and good. The vice president had her moment in the sun. It's not going to help me a bit in Chicago because, you know, as this person said, as a unionized construction worker, he's not going to see any increase. He believed that it's all going to help red states. We're going to all help southern states do better. It's all going to be the red states again who benefit from progressive policies, even though they hate Democrats and hate progressive politicians. What do you say to that?
Yeah, listen, I say, you know, first off, where the unions have prevailed over the years, yes, we've been able to maintain high Davis-Bacon prevailing wages. And that's good. But in order to lift our industry, we have to make sure that workers that are working in the non-union sector have access to high wages as well, and that there's enforcement of that. look, it's a good policy for the American working class, period. And it always was. And it's a good organizing tool for us as unions to be able to talk to workers and say, look, the unions have helped set the rates here. And that's the reason why you're making more money on your check. It's the reason why collective bargaining matters. And it's a better time to have those conversations now rather than any other time. Now, the other thing I would say is the policies of this government, Rick, will create more Davis-Bacon and prevailing wage jobs. So it will help that worker in Chicago. It helps that worker in Philadelphia. Yeah, this one particular piece, if in that area your wages prevailed, that's one thing. But you got to look at the overall package of what this government is doing. Pumping money into the construction industry like never before, it's going to create more opportunities for that member in Chicago.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Jim Williams, Jr., president of the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, IUPAT.org, the website, if you want to check out the work that they do there. Now, again, I come back to this, this Bidenomics, frame that they're throwing out there, that they are reshoring manufacturing. We are doing some infrastructure, even though this American Society of Civil Engineers says we need like $4.8 trillion. This is a good step and a start in the right direction. And then now with this to raise wages up, do you think we're going to start seeing more people heading into the trades? I know you guys are ramping up your apprenticeship programs and all this. Do you expect a wave of people coming into these? Because these are really good jobs.
Yeah, we really do, Rick. We see the next 5 years and really the next 10 years as pivotal for the growth of our organizations, and it's long overdue. I mean, we have been stagnant. I'm not going to lie. It's not like we've seen our unions grow over the course of the last 40, 50 years. And this opportunity that's in front of us is enormous. We've already witnessed, and listen, some of these projects are literally just getting out of the ground. There's an enormous electric battery plant being prepared to be built in Columbus, Ohio. Same thing with the semiconductor plants in New York and Tennessee. We already seen in the last 2 months the highest rate of membership growth in our union in the last 15 years, just in the last 2 months. And if that's any indicator of what the future is going to hold for us, we have a really bright future ahead of us. And it gives us an opportunity to bring people into our unions that never had opportunities in the past. And we are focused on that, laser focused on that, because our time is really right in front of us.
Yeah. No, look, we have, building trades people on the program who tell that story. How, there was a guy from the IBW we had on a while ago, who got out of jail and had no path and ended up going through an apprenticeship program. He now makes $100,000 a year, owns a home, and is living the dream. These are good jobs. They're jobs you're going to have to work at, but they pay a good wage, and it's a good way to be moving. My problem is we're coming up on election time and all this can go away. Right. Because, I don't want to be overly partisan with you, but I say again, Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. And right now the people who are in the House are trying everything they can do to gut any investment that we're doing. So elections have consequences.
No doubt. This election coming up is, we say it every time, but it's a pivotal election. It's a decision for working people. Do they want to go backwards into the policies, the failed policies of all the previous administrations? And I would even throw Democrats into the mix. Look, I say this everywhere I go. I used to have to hold my nose and vote for Democrats because the Republicans were the worst option on the ballot. Now, it's not the case. With the policies that have been put in place, with the way the party has been moving towards working people. Look, it's not perfect. We have a long way to go, but it's a start to something. And if we end it in just 4 short years, we're going to have a long crawl back. So look, I agree with you. I mean, right now, the way that party is, it's gotten worse and worse every day that we have to support those that support us. We have to continue to hold them accountable. We have to continue to try to push them on real things like labor law reform, which we are still far away from getting. But we can't turn a blind eye to the fact that this administration has been the most pro-union administration in our lifetimes.
I absolutely agree. And here's the weird little factoid, the little trivia game piece. Davis-Bacon, both Republicans.
Yeah. Rick, there was a time in my career where there was a solid block of 60 to 70 Republican congressmen, Republican members of Congress that strongly called themselves Davis-Bacon Republicans. That number ain't 60 to 70 anymore. And you know where they came from? They came from blue states. And there's few and far between anymore. The reality is, look, that party has lost its soul. That party is so far anti-democratic right now that we have no other choice than to mobilize and continue to push the Democratic Party closer and closer to labor's values.
And that's what we talk about all the time here on the program. But Jim, I appreciate the time. Keep up the great work, and I hope you'll come back and share some more with us down the road.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
Again, you check out their website, iupat.org. Jim Williams Jr., the general president of the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades. Want to hear your thoughts right back after this. Stick around. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com.
Open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1979. That was the day that young women workers at the YH Trading Company in Seoul, South Korea, staged a sit-in strike. The women made wigs for export. The company had been one of the leading exporters in the nation. But then the managers began to move the profits from the wig company to a shipping company under the same ownership, as well as to a film production company. This drained the profits from the wig factory and left it in massive debt. The owners shut down the company without warning, firing all of the employees. These women did not only lose their jobs. Water and electricity were turned off at the factory dormitories where the workers lived. A union represented the young women. The union planned a strike at the building, but the police were called in to break it up. The workers decided to move their protest to the local headquarters of the New Democratic Party. The party was in opposition to the leader of Seoul, President Park Chung-hee. The fired women were welcomed at the New Democratic Party headquarters. There, they decided to stage a sit-in to bring attention to their situation. The workers' sit-in only lasted 3 days. Then, 1,000 police stormed the building. They overturned furniture and broke windows. They dragged the women out of the building violently. One woman, 21-year-old Kim Young-suk, died in the raid. She fell from the roof of the building in a clash with the police. 4 of the union leaders were sent to prison. More than 200 of the workers were expelled out of the city of Seoul and sent back home to rural areas. Today's Labor History in 2 brought to you in memory of Carol Hillman, a passionate friend of workers and volunteer of the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's interesting he brought up the fact that there used to be pro-labor Republicans. And now, as I say, you know, Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. Look at what they do. Every red state has gone after gutting prevailing wage laws. Everyone has gone after gutting the ability to collectively bargain. And they've done all of the whole no rights at work agenda. You know, attacking workers' comp, attacking unemployment, all of that safety net that our grandparents' generation fought, bled, and died for. Let's quick go to the phones. Got Steve in Chicago on line one. Steve, how are you, buddy?
Fine, thank you. And I think that this is a great opportunity to sort of help people to link a couple of different variables, things that are happening and have happened in our society. Because there was a time when a lot of the Rust Belt was firmly in the camp of Democrats come election time. Now, let's then remember that, and then also let's keep in mind, with the decline of labor and unions in those regions, what have we seen? Well, we've seen a shift in terms of how those states vote. And they are no longer firmly in the Democratic camp, as recent elections have demonstrated. And I contend to you that the following, that a lot of those guys used to vote that way because the Democratic Party was perceived as the party of labor. They made sure the safe working conditions, you had benefits, you know, that you had a pension, and you voted Democrat as a result. If the working class white guy wasn't out there voting Democrat because he was some champion of civil rights or women's rights or the gay community or anything else, I mean, you know, we could try and imagine that they were, and perhaps they were some of them that were, but by and large, they were not. There were a lot of them were socially conservative. It's just that on the issues of labor, that's what bought them out to vote for Democrats. But as union power has eroded in those areas, well, guess what? Those people have nothing to come to the Democratic Party for any longer, at least not in their minds. I think that they're misguided. I think that if they want to improve the quality of their life, they should vote Democrat. But the Republican Party has succeeded in pulling them away because they're not, they don't see the Democratic Party as doing anything for them anymore because, again, union membership has declined dramatically. If you eliminate or rather just extract out the public sector unions in this country, the people who belong to unions that represent private industry, that's a small number compared to what it was in the 1950s and 60s.
Yeah, it's 6.7% right now.
So exactly. So these are the way that things are linked in our society. You know, so we've got to convince people that, you know, we've been here before. This whole race to the bottom thing, you know, hey, come to our state. You know, you can pay people next to nothing, relocate your corporate headquarters here, and you don't have to be in New York or Illinois or California. Come to Florida and Texas. Yeah, sure, you can come to Florida and Texas, and it'll take three of you working in one household in order to pay the bills. Now, yes, you can buy a home for less, and the cost of living is slightly less, except that not really, because if you take into consideration the fact that, you know, Texas doesn't have a state income tax, that means you're paying the full freight for the local school system, and you're not getting anything else compared to New York or California or Illinois in terms of social programs and things that you'll need in case the bottom should fall out, as it does with so many of us in our lives at some point. So, yeah, I mean, we need to convince them that we are on their side and that they need to be incentivized to vote. Again, Democrats need to get people to vote for them and not always be pulled back into this some of these social issues. You know, we can be on the side of the right people when it comes to transgender and sexual orientation and women and race. Yeah, all of those things matter. But the thing that matters most to us is we need to get people on our side when it comes to labor and work and who represents us, who represents the people in that regard, because it certainly isn't the Republican Party.
No, you're spot on. In fact, you know, the reality is we saw that time and time again as we did our tour last year. We went into the communities in Iowa and Wisconsin that, you know, used to be somewhere. You know, Toledo used to be the glass capital of the world. We went into those places and people still remember that, you know, that we used to do this and the jobs that were created and the lifestyle that it was afforded. And that's all gone. I mean, you know, the whole book, What's the Matter with Kansas, is the premise that you just laid out.
Yeah, and you were just discussing about the trades and so forth. I mean, there are things which, for the foreseeable future, aren't going anywhere. There are things that you can outsource to China or India or Mexico. But if it's 90 degrees out and I'm here in Chicago and my AC goes out, they're not flying in somebody from China to fix it. An American has got to come out and fix it. So, you know, there are still opportunities here. But we also need to be more inclusive. We need to create a bigger tent and reimagine union membership and the protections that we used to extend to factory workers to extend it to service workers and other people, because that's the new economy. And the people that used to work in factories are now working in service jobs. And we need to start that process of unionizing those people that were once excluded, because you weren't covered if you worked at the fast food joint. Unlike my father, who used to work at U.S. Steel in the 1970s and 80s until they laid him off. Well, we need to include other people again, create a bigger tent.
100% agree. But here's the thing: those factory jobs weren't good jobs until they were union jobs.
Absolutely, absolutely. The people need to understand: in 1969, a factory worker in America working in a union shop made about the equivalent of $140,000 in today's money. So you wonder how that person was able to afford a home, put a couple of cars in the driveway, go on vacation, you know, put money away for retirement. That's how. That's how. But where do you hear of that kind of that kind of salary today for somebody working in that kind of job?
No, absolutely. And you know, the woman that I played the video of from Alabama, who's wondering why her kids can't make it, you know, this is what she needs to hear. Because, you know, I talk about the trucking industry when I started. You know, back in the 80s, you know, a truck driver was making in today's dollars over 100 grand a year. Now it's about 45 grand a year. Where'd that money go? Well, we know where it went. It went to our 1%. And that's the sad reality Absolutely. Of where we are. And as Harry Truman said, if you want to live like a Republican, vote for a Democrat.
Absolutely. Great quote. Great
Thanks,
quote.
Steve.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. No, that's the reality of the world that we're in. And Steve laid it out so perfectly. Because, you know, that whole reward for work thing, there's got to be a policy behind it. There's no invisible hand doling out justice. There's no invisible hand ensuring that you're paid a reasonable wage. There's not. There's the benevolence of a corporate dictator. The only thing that stands in the way of that benevolence, that dictator, is a union demanding. And this is why I go back to Sean Fain at the UAW right now. Finally, someone is going, hey, maybe we should make what the CEOs are making. Maybe we should get the raise that they're getting because we do the work. My friend Sarah Nelson says all the time, you know, they've trained us to believe that we should just be grateful to have a job. We should just be grateful to be working here. And as she said, they should be grateful for us to come to work for them, to make them their profits. It's about time we start changing our thinking and bringing in people like that woman from Alabama and maybe a little education. In fact, we're trying to reach out to her to get her on the program because I think she's who we need to be talking to. We'll take a quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as I've been saying, Republicans hate working people. Look at their policies. Prevailing wage used to be something, as we said, you know, Republicans used to stand by. Both Davis and Bacon were both Republicans. Now, granted, Pennsylvania, New York, those were working class strongholds. Those were union strongholds, so you'd understand. But look, you know, I go back to the Gingrich era. You had some 90 pro prevailing wage Republicans. You don't have that today. And you look at the states like West Virginia, who have gone and done away with not just that, but right to work and everything else, and then have turned around and gone, look, you know, gutting this stuff did not help us. And what we know is prevailing wage has a positive reverberation effect throughout an economy. And that's why I've asked Lee Harris to come talk with us. She's a reporter over at the American Prospect, prospect.org, their website. She's got a piece on this very topic that I said, you know what? I got to reach out. I got to grab her on the program. Lee, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on. Excited to be here.
So what I liked about your piece, to be quite frank, is that it went into some of the history and the importance. I saw a bunch of reporting on it going, oh, the administration's going to do this, and not really talking about what they're going to do. So, you know, real quick, you know, walk me through what the administration's plan is to revive Davis-Bacon and undo some of the attacks of the past.
For sure. I mean, the first thing to say is I saw you had Jimmy with the painters on just before me, and it's certainly true that this is something that labor leaders have spearheaded. It's going to be one of the biggest wins for unions out of Bidenomics and the whole package of pro-worker legislation that the president has passed. But something that does get talked about enough is it's also going to help, arguably, potentially even help non-union workers more, including migrant workers, especially in right-to-work states, because it means that anyone on a job site that's being funded with federal money has to be paid that prevailing wage. So it lifts everyone to a prevailing wage standard, which is often the collectively bargained rate for a region. And And what's really powerful about it is, you know, unions will talk about this as it puts everyone on an even footing. So it prevents a race to the bottom, where, you know, out of state workers can come in, or out of state contractors can come in and undercut local union wages. But it also means that it sort of lifts standards for unions and non-union workers across the board. That's sort of the top line to understand. The way it does this is it reverses a change that was made in the early 80s. So from the time that Davis-Bacon was enacted during the Depression until the 1980s, a wage rate was prevailing if it was paid to at least 30% of workers in an area. That meant that often, if 30% of workers in a given region are paid the same level, that's probably the collectively bargained rate that unions have arrived at. Now, if there was no wage that was paid to more than 30% of workers, then they would default to the weighted average of pay in a region. But Ronald Reagan's Department of Labor changed that and eliminated that 30% rule to say you have to have a majority of workers in an area, in a given area, paid a certain rate. And at a time when union density was declining, that made it much less likely that prevailing wage would correspond to a wage that workers were actually paid, and much less likely that it would correspond to a union rate. So it made that kind of race to the bottom much more likely. One thing I want to say on the history is I love how you frame things in terms of this not so much being a Democrat-Republican issue, because I interviewed the historian Andrew Elrod, who's been doing really great original research on these issues, which I think has been useful actually to folks within the building trades. And what he's found, or I guess to kind of summarize his work, what's been interesting to me is that the history of Davis-Bacon being gutted in the 70s and 80s is really about both parties selling out workers, all the way from kind of starting with Nixon, but then through Ford, Carter, and with Reagan kind of dealing the final blow, but dealing with rising prices in the 70s by having workers exclusively take the hit rather than, for example, by considering more progressive taxation schemes. So yeah, while it's the Reagan Department of Labor that finally deals this hit to Davis-Bacon by eliminating the 30% rule, it's really Carter who sets the stage for that to happen.
No, you're not. You're absolutely right. It's the same thing with trucking deregulation and airline deregulation. That was Teddy Kennedy and Jimmy Carter who did that. But the Reagan administration used that and really put the pedal to the metal to accelerate the decline, especially in those industries. Now, you could argue, as some of my more liberal friends have done, that Carter and Kennedy had a more, we care about consumers, we think this isn't going to be as bad for workers, and they had an idea that it was going to help with the energy crisis that was going on and the stagflation that was going on. They had altruistic kind of theories that they were working on, whereas Republicans actually knew this was going to be the demise of unions in this and a way to crush those industries. So it doesn't really matter what their motives were. The results are still the same. We are in this moment. And I think that's important to point out.
Agreed, totally. And I think also the proof of how strong of a reform this is by Biden's Department of Labor is the fact that industry groups are so horrified by it. I mean, the Associated Builders and Contractors, this famously anti-union trade association, is probably going to file suit pretty quickly challenging this law. And I think the Biden DOL took a while preparing it because they're ready to go to bat for it. And the other thing is, there are these kind of, I think, political changes that are about supporting American workers. There are also just technical modifications to a law that hadn't been updated in 40 years, essentially. Prevailing wages had gotten really out of date in some areas. There's a great piece about how workers were being paid according to prevailing wage rates that were last measured in the 1980s. And it brings those wages up to speed partly by empowering the Department of Labor's wage and hour administrator to just say, okay, we don't have a specific survey for this region. I'm going to issue a determination for a given labor classification where we don't have enough data. And it gives a little more authority to the Department of Labor to set rates that correspond to what workers actually make.
No, this is a big deal. And I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, you think about the stagnant wages of the last 40 years and the drivers for that wage stagnation. This is a big part of that. In places that don't have strong union density, you know, outside of New York, Philadelphia, you know, Chicago, the big cities, you know, unions don't have the kind of density that they have in those places. So they don't have the ability to enforce and drive the wage growth in those places. So those places have been stagnant for decades. And it's been harmful, not just to those rural and other communities, but also to the bigger cities, because you do get transients coming through to try and take work and unscrupulous contractors who are going to break the law and misclassify people so they can cheat them out of wages, which, again, is why the enforcement part of this is so very important.
Yeah, I think where this is going to really matter is on infrastructure that's crumbling and the kinds of regular infrastructure updates that we already know need to be made, from roads and bridges to other forms of ordinary infrastructure, but also on these big new industrial policy investments that the administration has made in chips, domestic semiconductor manufacturing to compete with Asian competitors and bring back some of this production of cutting edge electronics, on the Inflation Reduction Act with things like EV production and solar panels and all of that green technology that we're convinced we're going to be installing, so it should come from yep. American workers. We have seen a surge in the construction of manufacturing sites, especially electronic sites, but a lot of that is anticipating money that's going to be coming down from the federal money that from the federal government that hasn't actually gone out the door yet. And so the fact that Davis-Bacon is being updated now means those really have a shot at being much better jobs for workers. And just to give you one example of somewhere where you might think that Davis-Bacon wouldn't be a problem, because a number of states have their own little Davis-Bacon regulations and already pay prevailing wages for all sorts of reasons. But this reform matters in sort of deep blue states as well, partly because enforcement hasn't been very good. And so just to give you one example of a positive story about enforcement, in Illinois, which has a very pro-union governor, the attorney general found that Rivian, the electric truck maker and Tesla competitor, Rivian's building a huge plant in Normal, Illinois. It turns out they went through subcontractors and brought in workers from Mexico who weren't paid overtime. Who were denied wages that they were owed and then just sent back to Mexico. So that it's a loss of work for the local economy, and it's deeply unjust to these migrant workers who are treated as easy to exploit. That's something that they only found out because of a tip from the local labor union that realized that this was going on. But a lot of these green manufacturers are not automatically going to be paying wages that workers are owed, much less paying prevailing wages, unless the DOL beefs up enforcement in the way that it's attempting to do with this law.
Yeah, I mean, I think every federal dollar that goes out the door, a prevailing wage should be attached to it. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show with Lee Harris. Lee's a reporter over at The American Prospect. You can check out their website, prospect.org, and her most recent piece on the Biden administration's labor rule. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at this. Now, as I said, I think all federal projects, all federal money, and look, I think even state money in places should have prevailing wage attached to it because it works. I mean, this is where I come back to the sanity of good policy, smart investment, sound policy. I look at the tale of two bridges, and I'm sure you've seen this, the Tappan Zee in New York and the Bay Bridge in California. You know, the one in California, not done with prevailing wage laws and not done with project labor agreements. The Tappan Zee done all under prevailing wage, all under project labor agreements. One is done on time, under budget, and complete. The other's never going to get done. And had it was $250 million to start. It eventually swelled up to $6.5 billion and is never going to be complete. So for me, as someone who is a little frugal with money, and wanting to spend the taxpayers' dollar judiciously and getting the most bang for the buck, this seems like smart policy because I've seen it in action in the Tale of Two Bridges, the one in New York done with a project labor agreement, done with prevailing wage, on time, under budget, and complete, the other one not so much. So this seems like kind of a no-brainer to me.
It seems that way to me too. The other thing to say is I think it it kind of complements the other big prong of Biden's manufacturing strategy, which has been, let's face it, the Biden administration is giving out pretty major subsidies to big, powerful private corporations. And he's doing that in order to reshore, you know, manufacturing and create jobs and to meet national security objectives. And there are all sorts of reasons that the administration has spelled out for doing that. But Biden isn't asking companies to pay prevailing wage for nothing. These are federal dollars that are going out to major, highly competitive companies, many of them with enviable profit margins. And he's asking that if the government is creating these jobs, they should be good jobs that support the middle class.
No, and one of the things I like that you went into your piece is that this is going to help raise the conditions and the standards in red states. And you know, one of the things I give Biden credit for, that you know he's a much better person than I am, I would be maybe a little bit more vindictive. I might lean a little bit more towards Trump and going after people who didn't support me. But Biden's, you know, across the board, helping the entire country. These policies are actually, I would argue, benefiting red states a lot more than blue states. And that might be a good thing, might get him more votes, but it's about rebuilding the whole country and rising, you know, all the boats and not just a few.
At this point, Brian Kemp, the governor of Georgia, has not met an EV he didn't like. I mean, the new battery belt in the southern United States is going to be pumping out just incredible numbers of electric cars. I mean, I do wonder, Rick, if it was... it was a deliberate strategy by the administration for so many of these jobs to go to red states, or maybe a little bit of a mistake on the administration's part, or if they were caught off guard by it, let's say that. And so one big question politically, especially going into the election, will be if they can take a victory lap and they're delivering these jobs, are people going to associate Biden with having delivered these major investments and lifted up whole communities? And it's interesting to me that it was Vice President Kamala Harris who gave this announcement in Philadelphia about the DOL changes, obviously not the most popular figure in the administration, although I think they're kind of trying to revamp her public face ahead of the election. Just an interesting choice, I thought. But yeah, I definitely a lot of these jobs are going to red states, and it's now Biden's task to take credit for what he's delivered.
And as I said from the beginning, and I said this, you know, right when the bill was passed, they should take that sticker that they were slapping all over the gas pumps that said Biden did this, and they should blow it up to 20 feet high cutouts, and at every project have a Biden did this statue, so that people do know where it came from. At least that's my thought. It is a start. Yeah. So last question I've got for you, you know, in looking at this, for me, the teeth in the dog is always the most important. You talked about the enforcement mechanism. How is this going to change? And are there any details about what they're going to do? Because understand, Congress is basically, you know, not funded a lot of these agencies that would be out there. I mean, I look at what they're trying to do to OSHA, the NLRB. I'm looking at, you know, the cuts that Republicans want to do. How are they going to pull this off?
There are literally dozens of changes that they make. And so I don't know all the technical details, but one that jumped out to me that seems like a pretty major change is that Davis-Bacon will now be effective by operation of law, which is a legal term that means the DOL can demand back pay for workers, even if contractors say, wait, we didn't know we were subject to Davis-Bacon requirements, which seems like a no-brainer, right? I mean, if I go and shoplift a store and I say, hey, I didn't know shoplifting was illegal, that's still on me. They're doing the same thing with contractors. It was the case for a long time that you had to spell out in bold type for contractors, by the way, you have to pay prevailing wage. Now that responsibility to know that they're getting federal money falls directly on contractors and subcontractors, which matters a lot because big brand name companies will try to evade some of these rules by outsourcing the work through shell companies and subcontractors. And so I think they're trying to put it back on the contractor to be aware of the legal requirements they're under.
So do we lock anybody up? Because I keep saying the only way this stuff changes is when the suits in the corner office are behind bars. Any chance we lock people up for this? Or is wage theft not really a crime in this country?
Unfortunately, I'm skeptical, but who
it's
knows?
It's not really a crime. I got you. Lee, I appreciate the time. Great
Thank
stuff.
So
great
much.
Report. I hope folks will take a look at it. We'll get links out so you can take a look at Lee Harris's report over at the American Prospect. Lee, thanks so much.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Good talking with you. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Ruby Ridge was trending today, which told me a white guy must have got shot by the FBI. And lo and behold, that's what it was. I just saw Ruby Ridge was trending, and my mind went, man, the FBI must have shot a white guy who was pointing a gun at him. And evidently in Utah, that's what happened. Evidently, this guy in Provo had been making threats against the president, against New York prosecutor Alvin Bragg. I guess it even gotten into some, you know, going after Letitia James, the New York district attorney general, the U.S. attorney general, Merrick Garland, Gavin Newsom. You know, he was an equal opportunity, you know, threat maker. But evidently he had the intent to kill at a minimum Bragg and Biden, according to court documents. So they went because Biden's supposed to go to Utah, I guess, on Thursday. So they went to pick this guy up on a warrant. And, well, he did what they do. He put up a fight. And, well, he's dead. And it's one of those things where you just go, I've said this for years. And I tell my kids this. And it's, you know, when I grew up, the place to argue with the police is not on the side of the road. The argument never goes your way. In public, it never goes your way on the side of the road or at your door. When the police come knocking, you got two choices: open it and deal with the situation, or they're going to kick it in and probably shoot you. And this is what happened to Winston Four Eagles. That was his social media name, and that's how he decided to post his threats. Now, evidently, he owns a sniper rifle, and you know, the kind of things that you would use to take somebody out. And as I was reading through the reporting on this, and I believe it was CBS News who gave me this wonderful report, talking about the fact the guy had multiple guns and all this stuff, and that, you know, taking out these, it was just a dream. What caught my attention more than anything, and, you know, some wacko with a gun, you know, getting into a shootout with the FBI, I generally don't spend a lot of time on. And that may sound cruel of me, but what caught my attention is they at the end of the article, she said, this is what they wrote. They're talking to the daughter-in-law of the guy who was killed. She said authorities have spoken to her husband, the guy's son, and he's trying to gather more information about what occurred. She said of how her husband was handling her father's death. He's just trying to process right now. I think that's all we're willing to talk about. This person added her father-in-law loved dogs and was a woodworker. He loved making sleighs and reindeer for Christmas. And my mind went to this place of going, wait a second. This is a guy who wanted to kill the president. This is a guy who put up a fight at the door with the FBI. Oh, he loved dogs and puppies, though. I mean, I saw this. I'm going, is this an attempt to gain sympathy? To gain some type of humanizing this person? CBS, do better. Simple, do better. And I know I'm going to get some hate mail. You shouldn't want to see it bad to happen to people, and I don't. But here's a thought. Here's a thought. Don't do what got him into trouble. Don't do this. Don't crime. I have never said that I was going to, on social media or anywhere else, do the kind of things that he talked about. And you probably haven't either. There's something. Do we need mental health treatment for people? Probably. But the fact that the family didn't know and the son didn't know he had guns? Give me a break. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Back after this.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, huge victory yesterday in Ohio. And in fact, heard a lot about what's going on. One county. This is remarkable. When someone tells you, hey, your vote doesn't matter, one county in Ohio, Clark County, Ohio, one vote. 16,015 people voted no, and one vote separated the no's and the yes's. That's quite remarkable. Quite remarkable. And this, again, why people should be voting. And here to share some thoughts on the big win in Ohio and maybe give us some insight on how they got the turnout, how they got people to vote, and what this is going to mean going forward, I've asked Liz Walters to come talk with us. Liz is the chair of the Ohio Democratic Party. You want to check out their website, ohiodems.org. Liz, thanks for taking some time for us.
Hey, Rick, thanks so much for having me. It's exciting to be here with you.
So this is a pretty big deal, but this one little nugget, I've been fixated on this one little nugget,
yeah.
One vote for the no side, 16,015 no, 16,014 yes. That just shows me every vote matters.
100%. I think that this whole victory you saw in Ohio showed us how much our democracy matters. And I'm really proud that Ohio voters showed up to overwhelmingly reject this anti-democratic move from the out-of-touch GOP leaders in Ohio State House and Secretary of State Frank LaRose. And what you saw across Ohio was volunteers, activists, from a bipartisan, broad coalition of folks, stand up, talk to their fellow voters, their fellow citizens about what was at stake in this election, and really make their voice heard. And those margins in our big counties where we saw, a much wider spread than one vote, but also in those counties where those races were close, what that comes down to is, just good old fashioned elbow grease and door knocking, right? So folks were out all summer talking to voters and it paid off. And it, I think, is a renewed kind of hope, a renewed belief in the democratic process here in Ohio. And we're excited to take a small minute to celebrate, but we'll be right back at it for the fall election here before too long.
Yeah, no, look, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, still in my heart. To see it be as radical and as crazy as it's been, To see this turnout, to see this vote, almost a 60-40, I guess, is probably going to be close to the numbers. To see it that decisive of a response to what was really an overreach, and mm-hmm. and you know, honestly, I don't know how with a straight face a Republican go, no, we banned special elections, but for this, well, we're going to break our ban.
Agreed. And I think my favorite post-election analysis from Senator Matt Huffman was the, well, we didn't win because we didn't have enough time to campaign after you set the election date, dude. Come on, give me a break. You got beat fair and square. The Ohio people stood up and told you to take a hike and shove these anti-democratic ideas back in the box they came from. So I think across Ohio, voters were focused. And, you know, more importantly, I think they sent a strong message to those out-of-touch corrupt politicians in the state house that, we won't go back. And two, no matter how you might try to rig the game or manipulate us by, you know, putting something on the August ballot, hoping we won't notice and it would just slip through, when you mess with our democracy, that's a bad bet every time. We're gonna stand up for democracy every time.
Now, you know, look, you look at these special elections, especially off-year special elections, generally much lower turnout, and generally Republicans and conservatives are get out in much higher numbers. And in looking at that, and I don't know how much more of a Democratic turnout was there yet. I haven't really, you know, digested all those numbers. But in looking at this and seeing that, you know, even in places that you would have thought would have been overwhelmingly, you know, Republican leaning, mm-hmm. like Clark County, that went for Trump by 23 points, that this issue, because this really wasn't just about the Constitution and that stuff. This was about the abortion issue that's coming up in November, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. So, you know, Secretary of State Frank LaRose said the quiet part out loud that this fight was 100% about abortion. So we knew that in order for us to ensure abortion rights in Ohio got a free, fair election in November, we had to defeat state issue one. And we showed up and showed out, right? But I think we also knew that while yesterday's election was about abortion, it was also about union rights. It was about voting rights. It was about fair maps. It was about civil rights and a whole host of important issues that Ohio care about. Those not having access to a citizen-led ballot initiative over the decades to come puts all of those things at risk. Ultimately, the ballot initiative process is the tool by which Ohio voters hold our elected officials accountable with when they are out of touch with the majority's will. Right. We have been judicious stewards of that. We haven't abused it or overused it. But given the state of our state house currently, we know it's a tool we need to hang on to.
Yeah, but the reason I bring this up is because, you know, if it was that issue, if really the abortion issue was front and center, that issue, Republicans have a problem in November. Because, you know, I look at the same polling I'm sure that you look at. Even Republicans don't want Roe to have been overturned. They want abortion to be safe and legal, and probably more rare than most people. But they still don't want people dying in back alleys. And I think this issue is a real problem for the GOP.
I agree. And I think it also is a real clarifying moment about choices that Ohio voters have. Right. One group wants to protect our freedoms, including women's freedom to make healthcare choices with the privacy of their family and their doctors without the interference of politicians. And the other side thinks that state legislators belong in the doctor's office with you. It's that simple. And so as we go into the fall, those choices are going to be made very clear for Ohio voters. But it's also something that we'll continue to carry into 2024 as we talk about the elections coming up next year, too, because I think the stakes have never been higher.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Liz Walter. She's the chair of the Ohio Democratic Party. You can check out their website, ohiodems.org. We'll get links out on social media, how you can take a look at this. Now, you know, again, huge victory. The messaging coming out of this, I think, is fabulous. You're taking on, you know, an overreaching Republican majority in your House and Senate. And good. I mean, this is something we have to have. But, you know, then the pivot is, you know, asking the, I think asking the simple question, how is any of this making working people's lives better? How is any of this going to help families put food on the table and parents help their kids, you know, transition into the, into adulthood? How is this going to make lives better? I don't see how any of this, any of the chaos we see by Republicans in Washington or in Columbus, I don't see how any of this makes workers' lives better.
I couldn't agree more. And I think Ohio voters deserve an answer about why the GOP leadership in this state spent $20 million of their tax, hard-earned tax money on an illegal August special election on an issue that none of us wanted. Frankly, they should all ask for a refund. But more importantly, it speaks to their priorities. And as the legislative session came to an end earlier this this spring, you know what we weren't talking about? We weren't talking about wages. We weren't talking about jobs. We weren't talking about prescription drug costs. They were talking about extreme stances on issues out of alignment with most of Ohio voters. And hopefully it's something we can keep reminding folks of going forward as we come into the fall this year.
No, I mean, this is, for me, this is the central issue. The central issue is always, how are you going to make the kitchen table a happier place? How are you going to be able to help working people put a roof over their head, food on that table, and make lives better? All of the divisive stuff, all of this stuff that Republicans keep throwing at us, you know, from abortion to same-sex marriage to whatever, is all meant to keep us in the red hat, blue hat category, keep us divided and eating each other while they rob us blind. And I want the Democrats to be the party of Roosevelt. I want them to be the party of Sherrod Brown and Joe Biden and really hammer on, hey, you know, we are making lives better. We're doing the hard work of making prevailing wage stronger so workers who are building this country back up again are going to make a good wage and it's going to help communities. That, to me, that just seems like the issue.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that as we have these hard conversations, one of the other important things that issue one did was gave Ohioans an opportunity to find common ground. As you've noted, the extremism we're seeing out of the GOP these days has been polarizing and pushes us into camps. And our defeat of State Issue 1 was a bipartisan coalition of folks from around the state who believe in democracy, who were able to point to the values we share. And I was telling folks going into this, you know, I'm from a big Irish cat, working class Irish Catholic family. We don't all agree on politics and had a family gathering a couple weeks out, and my devout Trump supporter cousin walked in my house and goes, hey, I really like your yard sign, that no on issue one yard sign. I said, okay, that's a funny joke. And he goes, no, I'm serious. This thing is bullshit. Power should belong to the people. Like, freedom matters, and who stands for freedom is important to me. So I'm voting no on issue one. First time in a minute, we voted the same way in an election, but also an important moment for us to kind of clarify the conversation with voters across the state about who stands for what.
Yeah, no, look, and this is, I talk about this all the time, so I'm glad you brought this up, because people, when I say, you know, Joe Walsh, the former congressman from Illinois, is someone who I call a friend, people are like, oh my God, I can't believe you're a conservative. No, we both believe in democracy. We don't agree on anything else. We both want to make sure that that ballot box is shows the will of the people, and that we follow the Constitution, and we believe in democracy. Again, nothing else. But on this is where we can pull people back together. So I'm so spot on with what you said there.
Yes, it is an incredible opportunity for us to have those conversations as we move, again, through this year, but also into 24. We know that, you know, the work is not done. The work continues in Ohio. We have a long ways to go still, but this is an important victory in a long war for kind of the soul of our state and for the lives of working people across Ohio.
Yeah. Now, last line of questioning I've got for you, because this obviously is going to be a launching pad for 2024. You know, obviously this November and next year as well. And out of this, I think having a real conversation about the abortion issue, I think, is something that has to be had, because what we've learned from our Republican friends, and maybe you'll come with me on this, maybe you won't, but what I've learned is when they talk about, you know, the abortion issue, they're just anti-abortion. They're certainly not pro-life, because I've seen no one come forth with health care, with education, with food programs, with anything that's going to help these mothers that you're forcing to bring children into this world. I've seen none of them bring policies that are going to help in that in that way. And look, I'm a kid who grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland with a single mother. So I know what empty cupboards look like, and I know what it means to have government be helpful. We're not seeing this from the Republicans, and I wish someone would hammer on this. It's great to say that you're anti-abortion, but don't try and fool me with pro-life, because you don't give a rat's behind about kids once they're born, only when they're in the fetus.
Listen, and there is data point after data point in Ohio that backs up exactly what you just said. I think the most important, one of the most important points we often miss here too is maternal health in Ohio. Ohio still has an outsized amount of maternal death in this state. And it is particularly profound for Black mothers and African-American women in our state. And so at a time when we should be doing more to ensure that families are healthy, to ensure that women are healthy and have the ability to make choices about their healthcare, we are taking important medical decisions off the table and giving them over to politicians in the state house who want to ban free school lunches, who want to ban teaching of science, who want to ban birth control. And so I don't know where these folks kind of cook up some of these ideas, but I think overwhelmingly we will see Ohioans unite behind promoting reproductive freedom, promoting freedom for women and families to have a safer, healthier life.
I got to tell you, let's hope this election is a launching pad to do some great things here in November and then carry that on into 2024. And maybe my state, my former state of Ohio, will find its way back to a bit of sanity. I'm hoping. I'm always hopeful. But Liz, I appreciate
one election at a time. We'll get there.
There you go. Always appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick. Great to see you. Have a great rest of the day.
You as well. Liz Walters, chair of the Ohio Democratic Party. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to play. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1927. That was the day the California School Employees Association was founded. Today, the union includes more than 215,000 members. But it all started with just 9 men and 1 woman. This group of determined Oakland custodians wanted to improve their voice on the job. They had come together to support an elderly custodian who could not afford to retire because public school employees did not have a pension plan. They met for 3 days to develop the framework of their union. Their first priority was to establish retirement benefits for custodians. Just 1 year after the union was founded, they met their first goal. They helped to push a bill through the California legislature that provided retirement for all school employees, not just teachers. Within 10 years, the union had grown to 10,000 members. They continued to work through the legislative process to win a 40-hour work week, sick leave, and protections against age discrimination. For decades, the union has stood on the front lines against the drastic public education budget cuts. During the 1980s, the union pushed for the cleanup of asbestos in California schools. They knew this was important for the health and safety of both the union members and the students they served. Since then, the California School Employees Association has continued to fight for safe schools and fair working conditions. In 2001, they affiliated with the AFL-CIO. Today, the union represents members who perform security work, food service, office and clerical work, maintenance, transportation, and library services. In short, without these essential workers, there would be no public education. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, ricksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Want to get to a couple of emails as we wrap up today. Sandra sent me, I get this one occasionally, and I'm glad Sandra sent it. She said, Mr. Smith, I have listened to your show for the past year, and generally I agree with you, but your repeated attacks on Christians is hurting your message. As a churchgoer and believer in Jesus, I am tired of liberals attacking our beliefs. Does it mean that much to you to tear us down? Is it such an infringement on your life that you mock and ridicule us? I think you would get more people on your side if you stopped attacking good people of faith. Have a blessed day, Sandra. I don't think I've ever attacked a good person of faith. I actually know a lot of good people of faith. And they are the types who don't do the judgment, don't pass the judgment. They're the ones who will help feed the hungry and clothe the naked and heal the sick. And they are the people who are community-minded and they live by examples. And when I read your email, Sandra, it's one of these things, I don't think I've ever attacked Christianity or Christians. I've attacked hypocrites. I've gone after people who, oh, I don't know, tell me that Jesus talks to them and that they've told them to do things like, you know, end abortion, but not do anything else. Like, that's it. You know, the day over, you know, but check. Now, as to meaning that much, I always use the Neil Young phrase. It doesn't mean that much to mean that much to you. I, in this country, believe everybody has the right to pursue their happiness, but whether it be religion or not. I don't talk about my faith. I don't talk about what we do because I don't think it's germane to what we do. I want to live my life the best way possible. The golden rule, at least the silver. My problem is people who hide behind religion and beliefs so that you can't question their motives or what they do. This is my problem in today's world. Most of the people who proclaim to be religious, who wear the religiosity on their sleeves, in my view, are not good people. They do some of the worst, most heinous things. They pursue policies that are destructive for humanity. Just my view. Now, I have, as I said, I have known really good, decent, honest, hardworking people of faith. And I was thinking about, as I was reading your email, I was thinking about my wife's stepfather, who you wouldn't have never known what his faith was. You would have never known that he went to church. You would have never known anything other than by watching the man. He was a good, decent man who would help anyone. Never preached, never asked for anything in return. Led a good life, was a good person. Can we get more Christians like him? Not the person who in the middle of a crowded restaurant feels the need to stand up and you know, shout their pre-meal prayer, showing us all how wonderful they are. How about just leading a life by example instead of preaching? That's what I would like. But I appreciate you tuning in, Sandra. Thank you. Lewis sent me an email, said, I just want to point out that why the Democratic Party lost the white working class is not just due to social liberalism Democrats embraced. It was also the elevation of the neoliberalist corporatist wing of the party and their advocacy of policies that was anti-worker. Lewis, spot on. 100% agree, without question. He goes on to say, which made the Democratic Party indistinguishable from the Republican Party. Hence, allowing the GOP, just saying it was mainly identity politics that drove away the white working class, is too simplistic and incomplete as an explanation. No, you're spot on and you're not wrong. But, you know, here's the thing. I think the point that was made earlier is a lot of Democrats at the, you know, working class Democrats, especially when we went through Iowa. When we went through Iowa, a lot of those folks were socially conservative, but voted for Democrats for economic reasons, because they were New Deal type Democrats, where it's about putting food on the table. It's about wages, hours, conditions. It's about holding corporate power in check. So when Democrats, DLC Clinton type Democrats came along and were, as you've said, indistinguishable from Republicans, they then went to, now it's the social stuff. Now it's the, you know, the gay marriage and all of the other things, and the right played on it masterfully. You're right. So telling the complete story is when Democrats turn their back on working people and policies that were put forth to allow a lot of this horrible stuff, all of the neoliberalism, you lost people. But we're in a moment now, and I think you'll agree, Lewis, that we're in a moment right now that we've got a guy in the White House who's trying to undo some of that. Now you go, but Rick, he was part of that. Yeah, he was. And I completely, you know, when he was in the Senate, there were votes I did not like. But the reality is right now, the policies that he's moving, we should be celebrating in the streets. Now, is it making everyone's life better? No, but we're on a path to do that. We're on a path to make those working class jobs good jobs again. The kind that one income can support a family. You go back and you think about those New Deal era policies that said, you know what, we're going to pay a factory worker $100,000 a year so that they can survive, they can make a living, they can support a family, they can thrive. You know, right now you got this race to the bottom. And look, that didn't happen out of benevolence. Those wages weren't because corporations thought you were worth it. They didn't. They hated it. They did it because workers had power. Unions had strength. Policy was in place to ensure that there was a floor. It's all politics. So when my kids go to me, Dad, you know, why are you so hung up on politics? Because that's how stuff gets done. There's no invisible hand. There's no invisible man going to make these decisions for us. We've got to do it ourselves. And we've got to demand better. As I've said 1,000 times, all of that socially liberal stuff, you know, I think I'm on the right side of history with, but it's not central to what I think we should be focused on. You know, the transgender issue, I've said this 1,000 times. We dealt with in my workplace 30 years ago. When Ross went away and came back as Rosie, nobody cared. Rosie got the same wages that Ross got. Same working conditions, same days off, same seniority. We've got to get back to that. And I think Biden is moving us in that direction. We have to be the ones to come along, though. He's pointing the direction. It's time for the rest of us to demand that we move in that way. We move in that direction. And it comes down to voting. It's that simple. I want to hear your thoughts. And again, thank you for the emails. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Tell me what you think. Something you like, something you don't. By all means, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Also, if you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.